Okay, questions from listeners from the website. Ryan C222 said, when the Constitution was enacted, the Articles of Confederation were thrown out. So the basis of our law system is the Constitution. Where does the Declaration of Independence fit in? There's nothing in the Constitution or any amendment that refers to it. Is there any legal precedent to be taken from the text of the Declaration? Can it be used for legal arguments? Here's an off-the-wall example. A 16-year-old wants to watch a rated R movie. He's turned away. According to the Declaration, all men are endowed with the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Can the 16-year-old argue that he is denied the right to pursue happiness by getting turned away from a movie? Great question. Where does the Declaration of Independence fit in our laws? It sits technically at the head of the statutes of the United States. And that more or less implies that it is the foundation for them. We have the right to form a more perfect union, we the people, because of the Declaration. But what the Declaration is less useful for is for specific cases of law. Can it be used in legal argument? Certainly. Can absolutely be used in legal argument. And if someone was deprived of liberty, I'm sure they'd want to cite the Declaration of Independence in their legal brief. It was often cited by abolitionists. Abraham Lincoln used the Declaration again and again in some of his speeches prior to becoming president, and then in supporting the Emancipation Proclamation and supporting the effort in the war. But functionally, it hasn't worked that well, hence the need for both the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing the right of all citizens to vote, and then the 24th, 100 years later, for virtually the same thing, just protecting that right to vote and banning any kind of poll taxes. The verbiage in the Declaration is probably too broad to be directly enforceable, though I wouldn't say it's a useless document either, because it certainly shapes our laws, creates the moral foundation for our laws. It creates a compelling emotional argument in cases where we go against our American ideals, and it adds a flavor to our laws towards individual rights. In terms of the pursuit of happiness, that's another one that's a little bit broad. Ben Franklin insisted that Thomas Jefferson put in pursuit of happiness. Jefferson had the verbiage life, liberty, and property. That was Benjamin Franklin's edit and reflects his philosophy. But happiness is pretty hard to measure. All of law is one happiness against another. And then you have the issue that you cite related to whether children are full citizens or whether the happiness of the child is more important than the happiness of the parent in knowing that their children aren't watching such a movie. So law is always measuring one happiness versus another. So it's not an absolute, that you have this absolute right to pursue happiness, but it is a flavor of law, that we're supposed to be going towards that goal, and that over-restrictive laws should be seen in the light of the pursuit of happiness. Ryan also writes, also, doesn't the Constitution allow a second, although never used, method for amendments? The states can bring forth an amendment, correct? And the answer is yes. The states can bring forth an amendment by means of special conventions. The conventions were kind of like the interesting toy of the Constitutional Convention. It was a solution that worked well for the debate on how to elect a president, and they decided to go with the Electoral College system, where special electoral colleges, or say conventions of men, would meet in each state and decide to pick the president, and how the state's electoral votes would go. It was a way of circumventing state legislatures. One of the big reasons for that was they didn't want who would become president to be A, something that would occupy a busy legislator's desk along with everything else they have to do, and B, they didn't want it to be horse-traded. So if you vote for my road, I'll vote for your candidate for president. And so they wanted a group to meet and just decide on this electoral convention. They also use this device, the conventions, special conventions from each state, to ratify the Constitution. Again, they didn't want state legislatures deciding this important question. It was something that was going to take a lot of time, and they wanted to have a chance to influence the process by reasonable men who would be thinking about it primarily and not thinking about it in conjunction with all the other things they have to do. So when it came time to constitutional amendments, they decided to include as well this feature that states can, through conventions, bring a matter up that Congress has not acted on. And it is another power of the states that's in the Constitution. I'm not aware of an example where it happened, and the only thing that's close to it is the amendment to repeal prohibition had a special provision that called for conventions to approve it in three-fourths of states rather than legislatures. So something close to that. But yeah, states can bring forth an amendment. It's one of those protections that's in there for states' rights. It hasn't been necessary because I guess usually constitutional amendments reflect a massive movement, and that has affected Congress to the point where they're willing to pass it. Don in Los Angeles writes, nice podcast, just one point on defections. When the GOP took back the House and Senate in 1994, if I remember, they got 2 to 3 senators to jump parties and a slew of House members, too. You heard the same drivel then about one of the two parties dying. And I have a Zune, not an iPod, so iTunes is not a source for me. But I will post in the social for folks to come and listen to this podcast. Thanks very much, and yes, one of the senators was Richard Shelby of Alabama, which early on the Clinton administration had tried to tame by removing an important NASA project from Alabama and moving it to Texas because he didn't vote along with the Clinton administration. Richard Shelby at the time was a Democrat. As soon as Republicans got the majority, Richard Shelby switched. So, seeing the Arlen Specter defection as some kind of a point of destruction for the Republican Party, I mean, would be a little silly given history. We have a two-party system, and so they tend to rebound back and forth. Doesn't look good for the midterms in particular, just because you're one seat down. Now, there are a couple of developments. It is true that it looks like Arlen Specter will face a Democratic opponent in the primary, so we're going to see if he sticks. Now, that'll happen. I mean, Congress people work their way up. They probably were held state office before. They were a county sheriff or something like that. They've put a lot of years in, and they want to be senators. Senators are the ultimate stars of Washington. They have power. They have the filibuster power. They have a lot of control. There's only 100 of them. Everybody wants to be a senator. So you can imagine a Democrat waiting in line, having a good opportunity now to be senator from Pennsylvania, given that Democratic trend in the state and President Obama having won there comfortably. Now it turns out that the Republican they've been battling all along switches and becomes a Democrat. So that's going to be a tough one to swallow. It would probably take some kind of real work from President Obama to get Democrats to back down and abandon that primary effort. And I don't know if that's going on. One example of this occurring on the Democratic side was in 2000, Michael Forbes, who had been one of Newt Gingrich's lieutenants, switched to the Democratic Party after a meeting with President Clinton. Republicans were outraged. His entire congressional staff walked out on him. That was even a bigger switch than the Specter ideologically because Michael Forbes had been in a pretty conservative. Democrats were also outraged, and they ran a primary effort and actually defeated Forbes in the Democratic primary, which, of course, as can happen from time to time, Republican help. The Democrats won the primary, and their candidate lost that election in 2000. And I believe it was Felix Grucci, the fireworks fellow, that took over. So nothing's guaranteed. Another note about Spectre defection, for anyone looking at some kind of a broad brush feeling about the Republican Party, you also have to understand that this had a lot more to do with Arlen Specter's personal situation. He was facing a strong Republican opponent, a Republican opponent that he had fought against in a primary 6 years before and now was coming at him for having voted with the president on his stimulus plan. He really had nowhere else to go but to the Democratic Party, because in the Republican Party was likely to be defeated in the primary. So it's harder to look at that as some kind of great turning point for Republicans. But that being said, the simple fact is that they don't have a lot of senators now, and Democrats are close to avoiding filibusters on most items. And practically they have a filibuster-proof majority unless they really try to push something incredible through. So, no need to look at a kind of broad brush, oh, the Republican Party's dying. It's just the simple fact is, in the current Senate, they're in a tough spot. And thank you for the note about the Zune, many Zune listeners that we have. It's about 14%. It continues to grow. We still have a majority of listeners on iTunes. You have some listeners who simply listen to it on the web directly, and some use other systems. But there are a good number of Zune listeners, and would appreciate it if, for those that use iTunes, making a comment and rating the show in iTunes is very helpful. And for those who have a Zune player, going into the social and identifying it properly is a great way to help. Okay, and in regards to our podcast about the flotsam and jetsam of the 2008 election, all of the little bits of trivia about that election, Eric LB writes, "I love the podcast, but I believe that FDR was an only child. One of the things we had said is that President Obama, by being elected, does not break that cycle of no president's ever been an only child." And I guess in this, it depends on how technical one is in the case of FDR. Franklin was the only child of Sarah and James Roosevelt. But FDR's father, James, had another son, James Rosie Roosevelt. Of course, James Rosie was much older than FDR, but they were in contact, and James and FDR split his father's estate when he died in 1900. James Rosie and Franklin Delano Roosevelt would split his father's estate when FDR's father died in 1900. And I don't want to make too big a deal of that particular trivia item. It just happens to be the case that no only child has been president. It's probably statistics and probability more than anything else. There's just so many only children versus other children, and there's only a very few group of men who have become president. Robert Link wrote, "The question of whether some amendments might be so unconscionable as to be impermissible came was raised in a state constitutional context in the recent court cases over California's Proposition 8, although the issue was muddied a bit by California's peculiar distinction between amendments and revisions. To my thinking, the big problem with accepting that some amendments are impermissible due to being unconscionable is that it leaves open the question of who decides the question of permissibility. It seems rather a lot of power to give to the unelected and generally unaccountable Supreme Court. It also raises the question of whether existing parts of the Constitution could be nullified. All in all, it's a recipe for a recurring constitutional crises and not a good thing for the rule of law, I think." Well, yeah, very good point, Robert. And I do think that the Prop 8 in a state context gives you some view of the question. Can you just pass a law that is just so wrong that it cannot jive with the existing law of the land? And it might come up more in a referendum system where all that's required is for a referendum to be put on the ballot and then approved by voters. You're just going to get more challenges to that question In the case of a constitutional amendment where Congress votes on it first and then three-fourths of the state legislatures, it has to be something that's fairly popular. And if something's so popular, one would think it's not going to be so wrong that it could be unconstitutional. But if a situation or a great mood in the country changed, that's possible. That's possible. So there is a question. Before Prohibition, the constitutional amendment was passed, there was a series of reviews from the Supreme Court, both of it and the Volstead Act that accompanied it and set the limit for what an alcoholic drink was. So there's some precedent for that. In fact, Prohibition didn't really start to take effect until 1920 or so, because the Supreme Court wasn't finished with its work. There was a interesting reading a book about the 1920 convention, which selected Warren Harding recently, and there was some question there as to whether delegates, this is summer 1920, whether delegates could go back to their hotel rooms and get a beer, because it wasn't quite clear if they were still allowed to serve. I think it's an open issue, and hopefully it's an issue we won't have to visit. Robert Link further writes, I can think of one plausible candidate for that scenario. Article 5 of the Constitution states, no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. It would seem, therefore, that an amendment to change state representation to be, for instance, based on population would be an unconstitutional amendment unless the states ratified it unanimously. That's a great point. So that's an example. Article 5 is saying that you cannot deprive any state of its equal suffrage in the Senate. But the other question is, did all the states, by joining the Union and ratifying the Constitution, also agree to a system where they will accept amendments to this document if three-fourths of the legislatures agree and Congress agrees as well? So does that supersede Article 5? And, you know, it's an issue that you sort of just want to crumple up and throw to the side and not worry. We'll cross that bridge when it comes to it. But, of course, the purpose of this show is to raise questions like this and consider matters like this. And who knows in the future if it might come up. It's something to think about. I think it would be a very unusual and rare situation. Richard Dierdorf writes, Bruce, I just listened to the Q&A podcast concerning Ross Perot's influence back in 1992. You raised good points, and the conversation's probably over, but I would like to mention that Bush received 10 million fewer votes in 92 than he did in 88, while Clinton received only 3 million more than Dukakis did. Those votes had to go somewhere. More importantly, it's not the popular vote that elects the president, and here Perot received none. On a state-by-state basis, did he take sufficient votes away from Bush to lose the winner-take-all electors? Well, thanks, Richard. I know the conversation's not over. Even though it's a past election, I like to think of podcasting as the bastion of debate and talking, and we can discuss an issue that's long past. You know, it's not TV. We don't have to worry about ratings points here. Where else would you have such a robust discussion of a past election? You know, many people would say, hey, it's over. But it's important for a couple of reasons. One is that 1992 shares with 1860, 1836, 1912, perhaps 1844, if you want to look at the Liberty Party, which kind of helped Polk get elected, as being a three-way election. And so it's an interesting thing to examine. It's very rare in American politics. So it's interesting for that reason. I also think it's interesting for another reason, because as I had said in the last podcast, I believe the 1992 election influenced how the presidency of Bill Clinton went. Now, a lot of people might say that it doesn't matter what an opposition party thinks. You're never going to win them over. There's no point for a Democratic president to try to win over Republican voters, or a Republican president to try to win over the Democrats. They're going to be partisan. It's a partisan society, and that's it. But actually, it's probably true in politics that you don't want to get your other side too mad, or maybe more importantly, too confident. And I do believe that in 1993, what President Clinton experienced is very much the 1992 election was seen as a vote of little confidence, that he won in a plurality, and that especially among the opposition party, Bush should have won the election, and perhaps Clinton didn't deserve to be president. Now, there wasn't a move to impeach him at that point. They saw the election as legitimate, but it was kind of like, you don't deserve that presidency, and so we're not going to reason with your legislation. We're not going to support you. When Gore went to Republicans to try to get some votes for a stimulus bill, he was told absolutely none. No one was going to vote for it. So the Clinton presidency was handled in a hostile manner from the get-go. Now, to your point as to the votes of Dukakis versus the votes of Clinton, Clinton getting 3 million more votes, and Bush got 10 fewer in his re-election than he did in his initial election. So where did the votes go? And of course, they went to Perot. But that would be a concept of owning votes. In other words, Bush got a certain amount of vote in the 1988 election, and so those votes are his and should have been retained over 1992. That I don't think would ever be the case in an American election. Okay, now I have to acknowledge an error in the last podcast where we talked about this subject. And Brian Fork from Madison, Wisconsin, was the one that pointed it out. I said that Bush 41 would have needed 80% of Perot's votes to have more than Clinton. And as Brian Fork says, you neglected that every vote Bush got out of Perot's beyond the 50% would remove one vote from the Clinton pool. So that's true. It's not 80%. It's something more like 65, 66, about two-thirds. Is truly what Bush would have needed of that Perot vote to win a popular vote victory. I do think two-thirds is still a pretty high amount of votes. Now, several people did point out that I made a popular vote analysis in a previous podcast and didn't acknowledge that the way the president is elected in America is through the Electoral College. So therefore, isn't the real question, did Perot cost Bush an Electoral College victory? That was intentional on my part. I used the popular vote because the real question is, did Clinton sort of steal the election with the help of Ross Perot? And if all the argument is that, hey, Bush would have won an Electoral College victory and lost the popular vote in 92, I don't think that's a lot for Republicans to hang their hat on and say, hey, you stole our close Electoral College victory from us. That's all. But if you're talking about that, you would need 10 states to change, all of which were close, so it's plausible, from Clinton to Bush. Georgia, New Hampshire, Ohio, New Jersey, Montana, Kentucky, Colorado, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Tennessee. If 9 of them do it, if 1 goes to Clinton, 9 go to Bush, that's not good enough. Clinton wins a narrow Electoral College victory. I think it's useful to examine what the question really is. It's not only, is there any scenario under which Perot helped Clinton? But the question is really, is one justified in thinking, in effect, not that Clinton didn't legitimately win the election, because no one's contesting that. They know the way the system works. Did people really want to vote George H.W. Bush out of office? And I think to adopt that posture, I think the evidence would have to be extremely high that that was the case, which it was not. On the side of Clinton would have won without any help from Perot, you have the polling, when Perot was not in the race, showing a clear Clinton lead over Bush. The exit polling covered well in the Associated Press after the election. It showed that the votes split just about evenly. You have the turnout argument, which is that if we're going to say that Bush would have needed a 66% of the Perot vote in order to eclipse Clinton's lead in the 92 election, that also has to assume that all of those Perot voters do indeed vote. Everyone that stayed home helps Clinton. Every American election in history where an incumbent president is running is a referendum on that incumbent and the incumbent's performance. And the fact is that if someone really wanted to continue with a president who is sitting in office, they'd vote for that president. It's very easy to do. Obviously, there were questions about George H.W. Bush, and so voters just had a choice of who they would pick that was not the current administration. Related to that would be the assertion that no president has been elected in the type of economy we had in 1992. No incumbent president has been reelected. Does it mean that in a miracle, George Bush could have turned around? Perhaps. But it just seems history was against him. So to be fair, if your contention is that the Perot voters actually would have voted for Bush, the couple of things that would buttress your argument would be that in 1996, exit polling of people who voted in the 96 election showed that 44% of them who were Perot voters in 92 said they voted for Dole. And the question would be, well, why did they turn around? And 92, they would have supported Clinton, when in 96 they were going to vote for Dole. But I don't think that's impossible at all, because 92 was a very different type of election. It was a very different economic situation, and voters were quite angry. The other contention is that the Perot voters were a type of person that would tend to be more likely to vote for Republicans. Probably on the whole that's true, and that probably is evidenced by that poll of exit poll in 1996. But I do think that the performance of George H.W. Bush was not delighting some of those same people, and that made 92 a particularly different type of election. Bill Clinton at least was attempting to run him as a moderate Democrat and probably would have had the plurality to win despite Perot being in or out of the race. Of course, it's a what if. Of course, we'll never know. But the real question is, does someone who sort of held an attitude of, hey, this election should have been ours, deserve that attitude? Michael Liggett writes, I've only been listening to your podcast for a year, so I'm not familiar with your archive. Have you done a podcast about labor and the Haymarket Square and the low prominence labor gets paid in this country? Some friends of mine remarked how the Chicago Haymarket Square riots of 1886 were one of the pivotal events in this country's history and a cornerstone of the worldwide labor movement, but that is virtually unknown or glossed over here. I confessed I hadn't heard of it before. When I looked it up on Wikipedia, I was surprised to learn that an American event was the inspiration for the May Day labor holiday celebrated around the world, except here. I'm guessing that our September Labor Day holiday isn't the same thing. Any thoughts on this phenomenon? Right, just the quick question about the holidays. We don't celebrate May Day here. There's an association with anarchists, an association with the Soviet Union. But just to be technically correct, the Haymarket Square riots of 1886 occurred on May 4th, and the holiday that's celebrated on the around the world is May 1st. And some element of that holiday comes from the fact that May 1st was an organizing day, or May 1st, 1886, was an organizing day for the 8-hour work week. The May 4th Haymarket Square rally was an extension of that, or a follow-up rally to that event. It wasn't called May Day, but there was a World Labor Organizing Day on May 1st previous to this. The May 4th riots, which may have led to an emotional connection to that day and having that day remembered around the world, but not in America. In America, we have the sort of benign Labor Day holiday after the summer, and that kind of reflects how conservative the labor movement has been here at times. But to go back to Haymarket, what happened in this event is there was a peaceful movement in support of the 8-hour work week, and as it was breaking up and cops were dispersing it peacefully at first, just, you know, the rally had been fairly calm and had run its course, someone threw a bomb at the police. It's not known who did it, but 8 police officers died. And then the police just went after the crowd and shooting and billy clubbing and et cetera. And we don't even know how many people were killed or wounded in the crowd. Many people were afraid to even seek medical attention or go to hospitals for fear they'd be arrested as anarchists. Because police officers were killed, I think that's one of the reasons it's not celebrated in America, certainly not in Chicago. I mean, there are small celebrations of it as a labor holiday, but nothing major. It's an event in which police officers were killed. And in especially in this country where, you know, not in 1886, but now, police officers are among the unionized jobs. So for a union to celebrate a day in which police officers were killed, that's a toughie. So labor gets quick mention in most histories of America. I mean, it's mentioned, but, you know, America is still a country that where freedom of enterprise is worshipped. And not just in this time, but in other eras too, the turn of the century, the 20s. We worshipped business titans in a way that others in the world don't. It's Trump and Perot and Gates and Buffett who we want to be here. Not so much lately, of course. Now they've been, those specific people, but financial titans have been discredited to a certain extent. But the average over time is that America's a pretty pro-business country. Everybody thinks they can get a slice of the pie. So we don't tend to celebrate labor unions, but that's speaking ideologically. The reality is that labor unions have been active in the country, are still active in the country, even with declining membership. And to some extent, even if you're working in a management job, the work of a labor union previously may be responsible for the wage you're getting, as sometimes management had to match the salaries that the labor unions were getting. So even if you're not in a collective bargaining unit, what you're making might be somewhat the result of the effort of a collective bargaining union. And labor unions certainly had a role in building the middle class of America, but it doesn't mean they're going to get celebrated. The whole idea of labor unions introduced a thought that might inhibit growth. The basic philosophy behind unions is that people should have a right to a better wage. Contrary to some American thought, well, that better wage is taking away someone's profit. How will they ever get to be a big, you know, business titan? So those are the conflicting views that are not a conflict in other countries. Although their numbers have declined in recent years, they're probably more politically active and influential now because we've had some low turnout elections, particularly midterms and primaries. So they can be very effective there. But the bulk of the labor movement in the United States, I mean, if you take a fellow like Samuel Gompers, has been more conservative and a labor movement trying to show their patriotism while they pushed for gains. Labor made its best gains in America when we were at war, both World War I and then after World War II. A couple of significant notes about labor. Theodore Roosevelt, although he didn't do anything directly for labor unions, indirectly contributed a lot in terms of federal policy towards unions, because he was the first president to arrange a meeting between a union, this being the coal mining unions of Pennsylvania, and the mine operators. And he forced both of them to meet with him, the president, and they settled the dispute. A dispute that would have disrupted the supply of coal, which was needed for heating homes in the winter. Very similar to oil today, coal was necessary then. Coal strike could shut the country down. So half being forced to do it, half out of his own interest, and half wanting to recognize the labor unions, or at least not shut them out completely in favor of big business, Theodore Roosevelt contributed. Woodrow Wilson is the first president to push legislation helping unions. And the Clayton Act, pushed in the early days of the Wilson presidency, helped to do several things. One of them was to make unions officially legal. There's some question about it because unions were often being brought up on antitrust laws. You know, laws that were intended to break up businesses were used against unions. The Clayton Act took that away, made unions legal in the United States officially. During the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's administration was very positive towards unions. Part of the New Deal strategy was to utilize unions to keep wages up, and the National Labor Relations Board was established, and that's still functioning today, and the Roosevelt administration was very aggressive in assisting union activity. The development to keep your eye on right now is what goes on with what's called the Employee Free Choice Act. Definitely a little bit of political linguistics being used there. Employee Free Choice Act, which is allows a union, could be as simple as if a office and the group of people who are not managers sign cards indicating they want a union, then they could get collective representation through this if this legislation passes. That means that many, many places that don't have unions now, offices, some hospitals, could fairly easily get unions without having to go through a lot of litigation, a lot of trouble, in some cases a lot of harassment. So keep your eye on how the Obama administration supports this. Obviously, business leaders are not for this particular type of legislation. There's going to be arguments that it's going to make things more expensive, and it might even reduce the number of jobs. While it might increase wages, it might reduce the number of jobs available. From my own view, I don't know how easy we should make it to establish a union, if it should be as simple as the signing the cards. That's something that's already available in many public sector situations, or if there should be a true vote. But some of the harassment stories that you hear about, or some of the stories where they have a vote for a union and then employer just pushes it and refuses to meet with the union. Tightening up legislation there, anti-harassment and better enforcement of the existing laws may go a long way. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. The archive of shows is available there for a small fee. We are on Facebook. You can go and comment and participate in the community on Facebook. You can even start your own discussion topic. There's over 350 people looking at that Facebook site. So if you do have something that you've researched and want to put up there on a discussion board, that's fine. I guess my only encouragement to anyone who's researching a topic is try to find at least one print source. And I really encourage anyone to go to their public library and look at the old history books that are probably sitting on the shelf. I mean, even if they're only from the 70s or 80s, it gives you a little bit different perspective because they're just not written in the same perspective that we have today. There's a general historical consensus that sort of changes over time. It's not always right, so it's good to get, hey, what did they think in the 50s? What did they think in the 60s, the 70s? I almost think you open the book and it doesn't have that old book smell, and maybe if some of the pages aren't loose, then that's not a real source.